Good evening and welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio. Thank you for supporting us here on the dial at 89.1 FM or streaming wherever you may be at lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's time for Midwest Beat, a program all about the arts and the people who make it and who are behind it and who hunt for it. You see, that's the topic tonight. People that hunt for very cool things. We're going to get the thrill of the hunt, if you'll pardon the pun. Joining me are two special guests. You'll get to meet them in just a moment after your headlines. And we're going to talk about all things collectible. From comic books to music to monsters to sci-fi to, well, anything is collectible. It's in the eye of the beholder. And that's seeking it out. So we'll be back after your headlines to do the thrill of the hunt right after this. Good evening and welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio's Midwest Beat with yours truly, Tom Lounges. This program is all about the arts, music, well, just about anything that's cool. Because, hey, that's what we're about, the cool factor. And tonight is the coolest of the cool. We're going to talk about collecting pop culture, whether it's horror, music, comics, magazines, all sorts of fun stuff. And it's all going to happen as we go on the thrill of the hunt with Richard and Brad. You're going to get to know them in just a few. In fact, you'll probably want to join their club. So let's get into the show and let's bring up some music that truly is collectible. This is a homegrown out of Marion, Indiana. You might remember these guys being on the show before. The Giants from 1959, Tornado.
She was a tornado.
Now that's a song that's got lots of collectability, lots of history, and lots of roots here in the region. That's a group called the Giants, Giants with a J, from 1959. The group was a garage rock band, a local sock hop band in Marion, Indiana. Now, Marion, Indiana in itself is a collectible place because it was the birthplace of James Dean, who then moved to Fairmont, Indiana. And, of course, all of that is history. And the Giants have a region connection, too, because Jerry Hedges, the father of Aaron Hedges of the Craw Puppies fame, he was the bass player in that band. No, I'm sorry. He was the guitar player in that band, and he was also my high school counselor. So there you go. A little piece of history that I am now proud owner of is collectible 45, and that is Tornado by the Giants of 1959. And again, out of Marion, Indiana, by way of Aaron Hedges. So thank you, Aaron, and I hope you are listening and enjoyed your dad's playing there again. With us as we take on this thrill of the hunt is Brad Toth. Brad, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
And Richard Dean.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Now, you guys are, if I'm not mistaken, the founders of Thrill of the Hunt. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's correct.
This is a, as I called it in my little promo, a kind of a social group of people who just like to find cool things and do the pick-in and all the stuff and come home with treasures.
Right.
Correct. And then share the experience. And we try to facilitate collectors finding new locations to hunt at. And
so wait, you give away your gold mine, so to speak?
Yeah.
You draw them the map and put the X on it for them?
Yeah, that was one of our big mental conflicts at the beginning.
Oh, I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah. We weren't sure if we wanted to give up the honey holes, as they call them, but we did, yeah.
So how long has Thrill of the Hunt been going on? When did you actually start collecting individually, and then how did you two get together? I guess that's a big question. When did Thrill of the Hunt start?
It's just been a little over a year.
Yeah.
Really? That's it?
Yeah, December of 2018.
Wow. You guys have come a long way. There's a lot of people that know about you, talk about you, socialize with you on the internet.
Sure.
And I just found out about you about a year ago, but I thought you'd been doing this for a while.
No, you were one of our first videos, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think we did like three or four. You were in the first three or four.
Well, thank you for that. I do appreciate it. We did get a lot of hits off that, too. A lot of people came to our store to see the collectible stuff. Richard, let's start with you.
Okay.
How did you get into collecting, and at what age, and what was it that flipped your switch and said, I'm going to buy all this weird stuff that other people throw out?
I would say I was probably around 10 years old or so. I grew up watching the Star Trek reruns, and merchandising wasn't as big of a thing back then as it is now. But, you know, I would pick up the Star Trek model kits, the action figures, and really always kind of treasured them, you know. Took very good care of them. Took them out of the packages, which, you know,
shouldn't do.
I should not have done, but I did. But still cared for them. And then, of course, the next big thing was Star Wars. That entered a whole new realm of collectability. So the collection just grew leaps and bounds with that. And then I also started following the band Kiss at that point. So there was a lot of Kiss merchandising out there that I think
they were the first band, maybe next to Elvis and the Beatles, who saw that early on, that really marketed the hell out of everything.
Right.
I mean, anything you could put your logo on, Gene has put it on.
Absolutely, and is still doing it to this day, yeah.
Is there a saturation point, though, for something like Kiss? I mean, they have, like I said, put their name on everything. At what point do you say, okay, that's enough?
I guess it's enough when Gene says it's enough. And I don't see him saying that anytime in the near future. And, you know, there is still definitely a market for Kiss collectibles, especially the vintage ones, like from the 70s. There's some really odd things that you wouldn't necessarily think would be worth a fortune, but the metal garbage can. That's a huge one, worth hundreds of dollars, in good shape. And, yeah, there seems to be no end to it.
I want to talk about the whole idea of not opening your toys in a little bit here, because that's something that still annoys me. I collect, and I do open my boxes even now, because I collect for myself first and investment way later. That's down the trail for me. So, Brad, let's talk about you. When did you get into collecting, and what did it
I've
for
always,
you?
Since... Probably I began to walk and talk, actually, because my mother was a collector, mainly of antiques and unique items. So as a little kid, I would be going to all the yard sales and flea markets. And, you know, I really got into collecting. I was into model kits, black light posters, of course, music, records. Then I hit those teen years where the rock and roll lifestyle took over.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of just faded out, lost interest in collecting. And then all of a sudden the big beer can craze hit.
I remember that. I still have mine.
Yeah, me too. And that was something that kind of brought me back into collecting. I got heavily into that throughout the late 70s through the 80s. And then I kind of calmed down a little bit until I bought a new stereo in the mid 80s and decided, you know, I need to upgrade some of my records. Get nicer copies, buy stuff that I've trashed. And at that time, CDs were coming in and records were fading out, which was a double-edged sword. Some stuff was getting hard to find. Some stuff was getting expensive. Some stuff was dirt cheap because the stores were getting rid of it. You know, you worked at a record store.
Right.
So
two-for-one specials.
Yeah, from that point on, it's been nonstop.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thrill of the Hunt... A little over a year old, you have a website called Thrill of the Hunt, and it started with you two guys, and then I know like Brian Pearson's jumped in and a few other guys.
Yeah.
How many, do you have members? Is it called members? What do you,
yeah.
Followers?
Yeah.
We're approaching 800 right now. We're at about 770 members at the moment, so.
In a year. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah. and it's climbing, so we're happy about that.
Now, the thing is, you give away your what did you call them, honey holes?
Yeah. Honey pots? That's what they call them, basically. Okay. Yeah, just, you know, places that are hot spots for collecting. And, you know, it can be actual shops or antique malls. Sometimes during the warm weather months, it could be as simple as a garage sale or a yard sale.
Wow.
And, yeah, you can find amazing things out there just about at every turn.
But why would you give away your source?
That was
getting my head swelling.
That was that was a tough thing we discussed because...
Did you, like, beat each other up over that?
No, we both agreed to it because, you know, we know ourselves. You can only make it to some of these places every so often. You can't be there all the time. We enjoyed finding cool stuff, so we thought, you know, if we start this group, let other people find cool stuff too.
Now, if let's say Brian's out there, mm-hmm. and he knows you're into whatever it is you're into, and he may not be, and he says, boy, Brad would like this, or Richard would like this. Will your members, your followers, your friends, will they like call you and say, hey, I found this, do you want it?
We do it all the
time.
So
it is kind of a cool networking.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the other thing too, one of the, I think, big factors for us, you know, deciding to give away some of these spots is that if they're not patronized, mm-hmm. if people do not go there and support them, they may not be around for long.
That's true.
So, you know, we're opening up the doors to potential shoppers, and that's guaranteeing their success going forward.
Biggest thing we hear, believe it or not, is when, let's say we did your store, mm-hmm. okay? How many people will hit us up and go, wow, I drive past that down that street every day going to work. I didn't know it was there.
Right.
Just serendipity. We got a lot of that from people in Hammond. It's like, I never knew that place was there.
And it's been there a while.
And it's been there a while. So, and I still chuckle at that because now, just from being a hunter, so mm-hmm. to speak, I'm always looking at storefronts.
I am too.
Yeah, it's bad because, what's that? Something new just opened up.
I mean, as a kid, we used to go to the resale stores, Salvation sure. Army, you know, Goodwill, things like that. And that was like the only thing we had.
Right.
So I would find some cherry-picked albums and say, this is a big treasure
right.
for 15 cents, you know, and you
right.
take it home.
Right.
Now those are like, you don't go there anymore.
Few and far between.
Yeah, the cool stuff people are realizing is cool stuff.
Yeah.
And that people will pay more money for it.
Well, records are hot again, too, so everybody
right.
wants records. Every once in a while, I still manage to pull a good piece out of a Goodwill or mm-hmm. Resale shop. I pulled a $300 album out of a resale shop, what, was about a year ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For $15.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a $200 album, one of those shops for $2 about a year ago.
Yeah, that was a great, what a score.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
a score.
Wow. Uh-oh, I hear music going. And what might it be? Bam! Pow! Biff! Biff? Really? Was that a word? All right. By now, you know that is the Batman theme. That's by the Marquettes, and that means we are shifting gears on our collectible talk to that of superheroes. We're going to get into horror. We're going to get into sci-fi. We're going to get into, anything that these guys want to talk about. But right now, let's talk about superheroes. Why are superheroes so doggone collectible again?
I think that, you know, ever since, I think they really hit their stride with Marvel back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Spider-Man came out, or 1963. Batman has always had an audience. Superman has always had an audience. But Marvel really elevated the comic book art to a different level. It appealed to a much more mainstream audience, a wider audience, rather than just little kids. College students were picking up on the books, and there was a lot of great word of mouth and excitement about it. So I think that's when the big comic boom really started. I mean, they go back to the 40s, of course, the 50s. Mm-hmm. 50s were an interesting era because they had the EC horror comics then,
mm-hmm.
and they were not regulated by the comics code, and they did some crazy things with those books.
Those were
amazing.
Pretty gory for that era.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And, of course, was that the Creepy and Eerie folks, too, or did EC come before that?
EC was before that. Creepy, Eerie, and even Famous Monsters, that was all Warren Publishing.
Okay.
So,
But all of that is worth money now.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Those old EC books are, even in poor condition, are worth hundreds of dollars if it's an original print. And early copies of Spider-Man, it's ridiculous. You can't even touch them if they're in really good shape.
And the thing is, like so many of our generation, had so much of this stuff, and we just lost it, gave it away, got destroyed. I had the first X-Men. I had the first Creepy and the first Spider-Man. Because I was a hardcore collector.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was just a little kid. I spent every dime at Kenridge Drugs buying my 10-cent and 12-cent comic books. I had hundreds and hundreds of them. I had the Creepy for a long time because I started realizing that's valuable. And then I actually had a dog that tore it up.
Oh.
It was laying there, and it must have smelled good or funky or something, and he started, like, tearing it up. Anyways, gone. But, you know, I would kill to have some of those things today. And I had all the Beatle cards. You know, Beatle cards aren't as rare, but they're still worth some money. And you just got to wonder, who's got my stuff now? Maybe you do.
We'll dust it for fingerprints and check just to make sure. But you know, and the comic book companies are really smart, too. I mean, Marvel, of course, goes without saying. All the movies that they're coming out with, all the different Spider-Man series, X-Men, Avengers, you know, they've really taken the whole comic book concept of the bank in theaters now. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it ever being a dying art.
And do you think the collectibles, because they're cranking them out now, and everybody knows that collecting is cool and worth money, is the newer stuff from the last 5 years with these new Marvel films and DC films that are out, is this stuff going to be anything in the same realm as the early stuff was?
It's hard to predict. I mean, there's some things out there that are worth a fortune that I never would have imagined would be. It just depends on the demand, how big the, what's the word I'm trying to look for? Like the pressing of the item is. You know, if it's in a very large pressing, that takes the value down because it's not as collectible as a limited run item. So it's hard to say. In time, yeah, anything can become collectible. Like right now with the newer Star Wars items, they're nowhere near as valuable as the vintage items. So
I think a lot of it comes down to is the vintage stuff, the older stuff. Most people bought it to read it, play with it, blow it up, burn it, whatever.
Yeah, I did that with all my G.I. Joe dolls. And my Johnny West and Chief Cherokee and Jane.
Firecracker to the ear or whatever. You know?
Yeah, melt them.
You know, people today are more conscious about it. They're like, well, that's going to be worth money someday, so they don't do that. A lot of people leave them in the packages or buy two, put one on display, and leave one in the package.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, I guess that's smart if you're investing. I'm not saying that's not a good idea. But like I said, I will go out and buy something, and I'll still open it because I want to feel it, touch it, put it on the shelf. In the long run, unless I am completely destitute and living with Leonardo and Raphael in the sewers somewhere, I'm not going to sell any of my collectibles.
Right.
That's my thing.
Right.
So is it wrong of me to open them and enjoy them?
No.
If I'm careful with them?
Absolutely not.
You know, I had a friend of mine, Brian Kellums, rest in peace, used to tease me all the time because I have a lot of figures that are still on the card, never been opened. I got a Jimmy Page one, and he's like, hey, when are you going on vacation? You need somebody to watch your house? I'm like, why? He goes, because I'm going to open all those packages and play with them. It drove him crazy. He goes, how can you own something like that without opening the package?
Yeah.
So, he couldn't do it.
But first and foremost, I think a collectible should make you happy. And if opening it is what it's going to take to make you happy, then go for it. There's no right or wrong with it.
So where are you guys on the fence post? You had mentioned, Richard, that you kind of kept yours in a box.
Yeah, well, you know, the early Star Wars stuff, the Star Trek stuff, I opened all that, played with it. I was a little kid at that time. I would have to say most of the stuff I get now I keep in the package, especially vintage stuff. You know, if it's in the package, that's a bonus, and definitely want to keep that integrity.
And Brad, your stuff is still in a box.
Clearly. Well, I got, like, I'm one of those guys that with some of the monster stuff I'll have still in the package, and I'll have ones on display, so I'll have two. But I don't do that as much anymore because the stuff's gotten very expensive, and don't have the room for a lot of the stuff anymore either. So I'll take something out of the package because I've got display cabinets and stuff that I could put them in. So if I get it in the package and I decide to leave it in there, it's just that kind of thing, you know. When we get into the monster segment, we can talk about monster magazines. I'm a freak with those things, so I bag and board all my magazines.
Mm. Now, we were talking about, I just went the other day, and I brought this in to show you guys. It's the first issue of Captain Action, where he's got the leopard, he's got Action Boy, and he's pushing Superman out of the way. Now, this was a guy that didn't last long. This series, they had action figures, they had the dolls. Mm-hmm. If you remember, Captain Action was the central superhero, and you could buy different costumes that he could change into.
Absolutely.
So he was
correct.
Like the universal hero.
Yep.
I paid $2 for this from a guy. He found it in a dusty box. Thank God he had it in plastic.
Yeah.
But basically, was this a good investment? Would you have bought this for $2?
Absolutely. That's a really nice Silver Age book. And like you said, Captain Action, it was extensively merchandised. He's well known. And being a first issue in that condition, I think you got a steal on that.
Good deal. Yep. Want to buy it?
Yeah. I'll give you $3 for it.
There you go. We're going to go into some horror stuff in just a second here. So let's do a song that kind of segues with us. This is Dave Edmunds from Neil Rockpile Band, and a song about one of those universal monsters. Lonely Fish Man, creature from the Black Lagoon, who spawned several spinoffs on that. And I actually have my good friend Doug Goines. I'm sure you guys know Doug, don't you? Who does Hollywood makeup stuff out of Highland?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Doug has done a cast, I think it was, from the actor who played the creature. And I have like a multi-generational down. Nice. Rubber mask of that.
Very
at
cool.
At the store.
Nice.
Interesting stuff. But a black creature from Black Lagoon, one of my favorites. But it is time to transition now to horror. And Brad, you were talking about horror magazines?
Yeah, you know, I've been a collector of a lot of the monster magazines, like Famous Monsters, Scary Monsters, Freaky Monsters. There's all kinds of them, trust me. The 60s had a great boom of monster magazines. A lot of them only did like a 10, 12 run production and went out of business. The big company was Warren Publishing,
okay,
who did Famous Monsters and Creepy and Eerie. One thing you could say about a Warren magazine, if it's been kept bagged and boarded or kept well preserved, There's nothing like the smell of cracking one of those open. Takes you right back to the 60s.
Mm.
They had a certain smell to them.
It was a real pulpy paper
that
they printed
on. Yeah, absolutely. And they did some knockoff stuff like the Spaceman magazine, Beach Party Monsters or something like that. But they were big for Famous Monsters, Creepy and Eerie.
Okay.
That were their mainstays. And they ventured off into some other things. And then Famous Monsters transitioned three or four times to different ownerships after Ackerman.
Are they still publishing that in any
form?
Yeah,
they just came out with a new issue on 292, I believe.
Okay.
So I've got all of them except one issue.
So are you seeking that out now? Is that one of the things
you're
hunting
for? I've got my eye on a couple. They're out there, so I'll get one eventually. And I just finished my Scary Monsters run today. I got all the issues of Scary Monsters. I got all the Castle of Frankensteins, all these offshoot magazines. Most of them I have every issue of. It's just the ones that are still in print.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to keep up with sometimes because they'll come out with variant covers too. Same issue, different cover. Just to make you spend your money twice.
Got
to
be a completist.
Kind of like the record business. You know, they'll keep repackaging the same Elvis songs 16 times.
Yep.
Beatles songs. The Scary Monster stuff, that has, or I should say Famous Monster stuff, that has been super influential in so many ways. The Misfits, Danzig, Kiss, all these different groups that straddled the rock world have gone out and said they were huge fans. Skid Row, what's his name, the singer?
Sebastian Bach. Yeah.
Another one into
Kirk
the monsters.
Kurt Hammett from Metallica is like one of the biggest monster collectors on the planet.
So metal and monsters go together well.
They do.
Big time. The thing with the Famous Monsters, like you said, Kiss actually did a cover of Famous Monsters. it was like issue 238 or something like that, where they were on the cover, so that was kind of cool.
Now, they also kind of paid tribute or homage to that when they did the Kiss Meets the Phantom.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That kind of stuff was pretty cool as well.
Yeah.
Now, is that kind of stuff, that knockoff weird thing like that, is that stuff worth money? Because
you know,
it blends the two?
It's funny because before people started pirating that and putting it on DVD and stuff, the VHS tape was getting to be like $40, $50 if you could find one even for a really low-budget movie. But it's such a cult-following movie. And now they've been, you know, I don't know, has it been officially released, do you know?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so most of it, there's a lot of people bootlegging them.
Okay.
But I still got the original.
You'd think Gene would cut that off and say,
right.
I'm not sure he wants to do an official release of it. I don't know how much pride they take in it, but it's an awesome movie.
That's just something you got to have, you know.
If for nothing else, the concert footage in it's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so.
It had its moments, you know. There's a lot of stuff out there like that, you know, just weird stuff that didn't go well when it first came out and all of a sudden became a cult.
Well, look at Star Trek, the series.
Yeah.
It was a bust.
Yeah. Right.
And now it's like a cult favorite.
Absolutely.
So I was friends with Gene Roddenberry for a number of years, and I have some cool collectible stuff, letters. He made me a flight commander. I have an actual signed Gene Roddenberry flight commander commission.
Nice.
And it's like, you know, it's worth the paper it's printed on.
Yeah.
But it's cool because, you know, even though I'm not really on the Enterprise, I can pretend I am.
Right, right. Sure.
I can say, beam me up, Jose, and he will. Let's talk about how people can join your group. What does it take? Is there like a membership, a criteria? Do you have actual meetings where you guys get together?
Well, we had recently brought on Brian Pearson and John Klaus as administrators, along with me and Richard.
On the website, Facebook?
On the Facebook page.
Okay.
They're getting more hands-on with it, too. A couple great guys that we've had the pleasure to become good friends with. And there's nothing other than sending a request to join our Facebook group page. And every once in a while, we'll send some invites out. We haven't done a lot of promotion. I'm wanting to start doing a little bit more promotion, But we've kind of let it grow on its own so far.
Okay. Yeah,
it's grown very naturally through word of mouth and, you know, people who have joined the group and like, you know, what we're doing and like being in the group. They'll tell a few friends, like the old commercial and so on and so on. And, yeah, it's been growing very organically.
Do you see the day when Thrill of the Hunt and its different collector members will host their own event?
We've talked about it already.
Like a Comic-Con type thing?
Yeah,
but of
absolutely.
Like all kinds of stuff?
We've been taking some small steps in that direction. Thrill of the Hunt is actually set up at events like Haunting in Hammond, which happened in October. So, yeah, we've tried to establish a little bit more of a presence at these events. Yeah, and someday, you know, we could definitely set up an event of our own. We're definitely one of the main reasons we're bringing John and Brian into the group is, you know, besides being great guys, they're great thinkers and they have great ideas.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And we think that they're going to do a lot for the group as far as growing it and bringing some fresh ideas to the table. We just did a benefit auction for Australia.
I saw that online. Tell me about that. I didn't really get to absorb that too much. What was that about?
I've been following, you know, the situation in Australia very closely. And, you know, just like anyone else, seeing the photos of the animals that have fallen victim to the fires. And the one thing that really captured my attention in a bad way was a satellite photo of Australia. And it just looked like the whole continent was on fire. And just in a small way, I wanted us to kind of use the connections that we have and the presence that we have on social media to try to raise some money for Australia and the situation that they're in. So we held a fundraising auction. And
Was it strictly online or did you go somewhere?
No, strictly online.
Okay.
It was through our page. And we had a lot of generous people post items that they were willing to part with and raise money. And it went very well, considering it was the very first time we had done anything like that. But again, you know, that's, you know, something that we're trying to do with the group is take it in different directions and, you know, become more of a presence and actually do some good productive things with it.
We also highly encourage our members to throw suggestions. If they have ideas and suggestions that they would like to see or maybe implemented into the group, we're always open to that, too. We want everybody. The biggest thing with this thing is we had fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We want our members to have fun, too. We want this to be a fun, you know, enjoy this. It's a step outside of reality. It's stuff you love to do, so enjoy it.
Like you said, whether you want to open the box or not, if it means something to you and you have fun doing it, do it.
Exactly.
No
exactly.
rules.
That's right.
Exactly.
All right. All right, we're going to segue again, and kind of a nice follow-up with horror, but we're going to take it in a little different direction. You may remember this theme.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family. Their house is a museum. When people come to see them, they really are a scream, the Addams Family. Neat. Sweet. Petite. So get a witch's shawl on, a broomstick you can crawl on. We're gonna pay a call on the Addams Family.
All right, everybody snap your fingers, come on. Addams Family, of course, the rivals of the Munsters. And the Hollywood thing, you were talking about the scary monsters, the famous monsters, the horror films, the Universal monsters, kind of carried over to the small screen because in the 60s, well, the 50s TV really started to get a little bit of footage. But by the 60s, every home had a TV, it seemed.
Yeah.
Mostly black and white, but still we had TVs. And the horror fascination transferred to that small screen well with the Addams Family, with Outer Limits and Twilight Zone, and, of course, the Munsters. And you guys, along with Karen and Raimundo and some of the other folks, Brian, were part of this group that brought Eddie Munster, Butch Patrick, to Hammond for the Haunting of Hammond this year. So what was that all like to actually meet some of the people that you've, you know, idolized as collectors?
It was awesome. It was awesome. Just to sit down with Butch Patrick, I sat down with him for about 20 minutes, half hour, and just talk like we're talking.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm sitting next to this guy I used to watch faithfully and still do.
Mm-hmm.
Big fan of that show. And
he could rock those shorts.
Yep.
Yeah.
those eyebrows.
And he worked with some great actors.
That's true.
I mean, that's one thing we talked about. How cool would it be to work with Fred Gwynn or
Yvonne DiCarlo?
Yvonne DiCarlo.
She was smoking.
Oh. Yep.
I mean,
even as a corpse, she was smoking.
Al Lewis was a great, funny guy. Mm-hmm. Between him and Fred Gwynn, they were a great team.
I've got a picture of Al as Grandpa holding Midwest Beat magazine.
Really?
Nice. Yeah, it's nice. A classic. I'll have to post that. We'll have to share that with Thrill of the Hunters. But I remember interviewing Butch a couple of times when he was doing his punk rock band, Eddie and the Monsters. He was on tour with Peter Tork in the Peter Tork Project. And I've got a shot of us hanging out at the bar together. And when he was there at the Haunting of Hammond, I was, of course, on guard duty at the line for Sven Gulli, so I couldn't really wander. And he walked by, and I'm like, hey, Butch, you want to talk about, you know, Eddie and the Monsters? He goes, hell no. That was a lifetime ago. He goes, I'm getting something to drink. And he went over to the bar. So I never got a chance to really talk to him about it. But it's good to hear that he still, you know, is into that. I mean, that's his history. It's something he should be proud of.
He had the coach and the Dragula out there, which is really cool.
Those are the cars, for those that may not remember that.
Yeah.
They were pretty badass, too.
Yeah. It was a good time. It was, a lot of people involved behind the scenes on that put that together.
And mm-hmm.
We were just happy to be a part of it.
And, of course, Sven Gulli.
Absolutely.
You know, who's been a part of Chicago for decades, and now he's international thanks to WGN going. So it was GN, right? Or is it FLD? I can't remember where he's
at. He's
on
MeTV now.
MeTV.
Everybody buys each other out. I can't.
Yeah,
keep track
I know.
Of it all.
Yeah.
So anyway, he's out there coast to coast now, along with Elvira.
Right.
We got to get her out. I know Cassandra a little bit.
That would be cool.
We should be able to get her out. Yeah. I got a funny story I don't want to share on air about that. But
and I'm happy for all those people because they paid their dues. I mean, they're icons.
Yeah. So, and the thing is, a lot of people complain, and you probably hear it too. You go to the Comic-Cons, you go to the conventions, and they're saying, I can't believe that you're charging $5 or $10 for your autograph. Well, let's go back to the times they were famous. Most, if not all of them, do not get residuals.
Right.
Munsters can show 150 times a day, and they won't get a penny.
That's right.
Because they signed a work, basically a work project.
Yeah,
you know?
Not like it is today.
It's not like it is today. And that was the case with all those TV stars.
Yeah.
And, you know, no one knew they were going to be cult favorites later, and nobody thought, okay, it's going to air one time and be gone.
Right.
I just read that on Gilligan's Island, for instance, the only one that gets residuals is Marianne.
Really?
Her agent was smart enough that everyone got residuals for 5 episodes.
Okay.
Figuring, okay, it might air another couple times.
Sure.
Up to 5, and they were cut off, even Gilligan. And Jim Backus, all those famous folks. But Marianne still gets it. She still gets it. It's a small percent.
Right.
I read about that. I thought, good for you.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
And going back to what you were saying, Tom, about the charges for the autographs, I mean, what Butch was charging for an autograph is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what most celebrities charge at these convention settings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, he's a legend. You know, he's been such an influential part of TV for so many years. And, you know, going back to the Sven Gulli thing and Elvira, I'm just, you know, as many things that are going wrong in the world, I'm glad we're still in a world that has horror hosts and that they can actually be recognized and grow and have a following. So that's great.
That's when being, you know, scared was fun.
Sure.
Now we turn on the news and we're scared in a not fun way.
No, it's a
whole different reason.
You know, that's what the fun part about collecting and being a fan of this stuff. There's always that thrill of the hunt. You know, that item you want, or
that person you want to meet,
and when you're in that moment, the rest of the world doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're living the dream. You're living a situation you can't pay for. You know,
right?
So I think that's really cool. And as far as TV show collectibles go, in the shows, there's a lot of them that are gotten really hot again. They brought back the Time Tunnel back on TV late at night.
Land of the Giants.
Land of the Giants.
Invaders.
Invaders. You know, there's so many that were classic Irwin Allen type of things that they put out back then. All that stuff's getting another breath of air.
Mm-hmm.
And just goes to show you, you know, it's good classic sci-fi is very, very in demand. And
no, we grew up with that stuff.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
if it was just reruns in some cases.
Sure.
What about the young kids that are out there? You're out there doing this with a lot of people. Are we seeing younger kids coming up? I know Brian's daughter is into it because
yeah.
she grew up with Brian, obviously, as her dad.
Right.
But
right.
are we seeing a lot of younger folks that are getting into collecting and getting into the horror stuff?
I don't know if I'd say stuff? A lot. There's a decent percentage. I wouldn't say a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I have a joke about, like, when we're not here anymore, our stuff's going to be landfill filler or our lives will become an auction when it's all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got to think, who's going to buy our stuff or where
right.
is it going to go? If you're a serious collector, you want it to go to serious people.
Right.
You don't want it shoved in the alley or taken to the Goodwill when you've got half your life's money invested
and
into
time.
It. And time. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, I think the one thing that's pulling younger people toward collecting is the resurgence of vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, because they're starting to go, oh, look at that. That's cool. It's something non-vinyl. They see at a record store or at a convention or whatever. There's a lot of stuff out there.
And well, they're remaking a lot of the classic lunchboxes
sure.
and mugs
mm-hmm. sure.
with branding on it. And they're not authentic, but they're collectible now to the kids. They think they're cool.
Sure. Right.
And I'm finding more and more high school age kids that are getting into collecting records
yeah.
would rather have the original pressings
sure.
than the 180 gram, even though they'll sound better, look better,
right.
and are in pristine shape. They'll gamble a few extra dollars to buy that original Led
right.
Zeppelin or
right.
Jimi Hendrix from 1968 or 72
yeah.
or whatever.
And I think, you know, you had mentioned Brian's daughter. You know, she's awesome. She's
mm-hmm.
a very old soul and a young person. And I think a lot of what we do, you know, guys that are our age, ladies that are our age, their kids see the fun that they're having with this.
The mom and dad still play with dolls.
Yeah, yeah. exactly. right, right. And it's infectious, you know, and I think that a lot of times, you know, they want to be part of that, and it's appealing to them. So I can see, you know, collecting and vintage growing as time goes by.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be a market.
We're going to play one more song, and it's going to be a little snippet here to take us out of this segment. And we're going to focus on music because we're down to about 15 minutes here, and music is something I definitely want to touch on. Let's take it out of here by giving you some sci-fi meets TV history. This is Out of Limits, once again, the Marquettes. The theme of Outer Limits rocked up there a little bit from the, I want to say it was the early 60s, mid-60s. Marquettes was the group. Same one that gave us the Batman theme earlier in the show. This is Midwest Beats. I'm Tom Lounges, and you're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial or streaming at lakeshorepublicradio.org. If you are online, you may want to shuffle on down and open another tab, as they call them, and go to Thrill of the Hunt at facebook.com. And you get to meet the guys that are here tonight. We are having a good time talking about collecting. Richard Dean is with us. Brad Toth is with us. They are the co-founders of Thrill of the Hunt. In fact, they're looking at me right now from my screen as I see the creature's head and all these other things behind them. you guys look kind of Ghostbustery in this.
Yeah. Then we succeeded, I guess.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about music, but first let's talk a little bit about the video project. Now, that is something that's growing in leaps and bounds. The two of you take some cameras, you go to these honey holes, and you expose them to the public. And like you said, I was one of the first ones you did, which I didn't realize, and that was very cool. So, and Ernie down in Hobart has had his done, and I know Josh and Joe down at Region Records have been part of it. And Karen Marvella over at It's Serendipity, or Just Serendipity.
Yeah.
I got to correct that. How do you find these places? And are you finding that they're open to this? Do they think you're crackpots when you first walk in with a handheld camera and say, hey, we're going to do this?
We have a weird system, and it's always works. We walk into a place, and we'll know within 2 or 3 minutes of walking through that door, the people are at the counter. You have a brief conversation with if you could tell if they're going to be into it or not, or think you're nuts. Most people are very into it. We got some good ones in the works for waiting on one place to finish remodeling. Trying to reach out 2020 for some really cool things. But the thing is, most places are very much into it because they're getting their business exposed to maybe a new audience that didn't know about them. And I got to send a shout out to Joe from Region. Huge supporter of this page that we do, and has brought a lot of collectors to us.
I used to buy comic books from Joe.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. And baseball cards.
Yeah. He's a legend in his own way, you know. And, you know, to me, giving people a little insight to these stores, like I said, they might have driven by them 20 times and never paid attention. They don't know what's on the other side of that glass. It's getting in there.
It's a treasure.
And saying, look at all this stuff in here. And it's crazy because we did one in Niles, and I know a couple people that drove up there the next weekend to Niles just to go to that one shop we shot because they saw, oh, God, I got to go check it out.
Niles, Michigan.
Yeah, right. Yeah. How long do these episodes tend to last?
You know, we do like 3 or 4 segments, 4 or 5 minutes long each.
Okay.
Depends on how big it is, too.
Yeah, we try not to drag the segments out
so
too
just
much.
Little snippets to just whet the appetite, so
yeah.
To speak.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, because you put a 20-minute video together, people start getting bored watching it.
Right. So. All right, I'm gonna put you on the spot and ask you each to name the one item in your collection that you would never ever part with that you consider your pièce de résistance. What's the most valuable thing? If you had one time to take one item out of a burning house, what would it be?
Wow, that is a tough.
Yeah, I'm gonna let you answer this first, because I gotta think for a second here.
Wow, you know, you know, I can't think of, say, per se, one particular item. I would grab whatever I could,
okay,
whether it's worth money or not, just to save something if the house was on fire.
Okay.
As far as particular item, it's probably, you know, I have a few things that are were like handmade and stuff like that. There weren't production things that are very cool. Those kind of things would be, to me, more sentimental than something you could buy, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a tough question. That's tough.
All right, Richard, your turn.
All right, well, tough question, weird answer here. About a year ago, I picked up a mannequin torso at an auction. And it was just a few bucks. Again, just the bottom half of this mannequin. And I don't know where I came up with this idea, but I decided to make it a Kiss tribute. So I hand-drew all these Kiss-themed tattoos all over this mannequin. And I worked on this for about 2 or 3 months. And so a lot of it was a labor of love. I guess that would be like why I would possibly grab this thing. But half of the people I tell about this thing think it's incredibly cool. The other half think I'm just absolutely out of my mind for having this thing. So I got it propped up in my little Kiss shrine at home, and I love it. I just think it's cool and unique, and that'd be probably the first thing I would grab.
All right. We've got a couple minutes left. We do have a song we want to get to. Let's talk about finding cool music. Each of you, tell me about an album or something that you found in the musical world in your hunts.
I found a lot. I've been collecting records since I was 10 years old. And I went through that phase. Like I said, I'm too cool. You know, let's go out and party and play music. And kind of got lost in that for a while. And then, like I said, I bought a new stereo and started rebuilding. Probably had 500 records in 1985. And it went from like that to 1,000 within like 3 months. And just kept growing and growing and growing. And that's how that goes. I have found some really cool pieces as far as vinyl. Unfortunately, some of the stuff gets reissued. I found a couple really rare pieces. I did find, trying to think of the name of that band. I can't think of it. But I found a very, very expensive album at the Goodwill. Sat on it for 10 or 15 years till I realized how much it was worth and about fell over.
Wow.
And I ended up letting it go as a promotional copy because they reissued it. So I bought it wasn't that important to me. I found some great pieces. The first Pentagram album, I found dirt cheap. I got a CD I brought by a band called Recon. Unfortunately, they just reissued that. That used to be a really hard CD to find. It was $40, $50 if you could even find one. I found it for $1. I was like, oh, that's cool, you know. So there's stuff's out there. I mean, it's out there. I still find every once in a while you find that nugget in that pile of junk. And
right.
Very few and far between at the thrift stores because everybody and their brother does the same thing.
Right.
But every once in a while.
And most of what you find there is Mantovani or the 101 Strings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A few Streisands or Engelberts in there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Those are the gems of what you find.
The holiday albums.
Yeah.
Now, don't laugh at the holiday albums. I do real well around Christmas.
I bet you do.
There you go.
But, it's Perry Como and, you know, Tijuana Brass.
Yeah, a lot of that. And it's a shame because Herb Alpert's actually quite gifted. But that's a theme for another show. Richard, you brought something, and this is an act that was huge. And I am not familiar with this album, and I run a record store. I've never heard of it, called Down to the Bone. Is this one of your rare finds?
It is. I found that at an antique mall in downtown Crown Point, and I think I paid maybe $3 for it.
Wow. 1995.
Yep.
Kamikaze Records, so that was an indie. This is after their glory days. And, of course, we're talking about a band produced by Kevin DeBrow. And if you remember that name, he was lead singer, late great Kevin, no longer with us. Quiet Riot. And I love the artwork on this.
Yeah. Very
Is that
doomy.
What it attracted you to it?
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of a dark, gloomy album cover for Quiet Riot.
Yeah,
and but I saw the mask on the cover, recognized it for what it was immediately, and just had to grab it.
Excellent. Well, let's play something from this. I don't know if this is going to take us out, Jose. Is this going to do it? Okay, gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Again, Thrill of the Hunt on Facebook. Join the group. Watch the videos, explore their honey holes, and become a collector. And this is Quiet Riot off the Down to the Bone album, which none of us had ever heard before, and their treatment of a classic Kinks song, All Day and All the Night. This is Midwest Beat. Join me this Friday. I'll have Marco Villarreal on the show and Nick Cazonis, two great musicians from the region, and that's Friday from 1 to 3 before Chef Nick joins us with Let's Eat. This is Quiet Riot. I'm Lounges, and I'm out of here. Adios.